The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to Anoush Kalian and George Eaton about the surprisingly upbeat mood at Tory party conference. Ian Steadman and I will be tackling the new ways that copyright law is being enforced on the internet, and Philip Morn will talk to Caroline Crampton about the last work of the late composer John Taverner. Well, we've nearly made it to the end of conference season, only Lib Dems to go, and I'm joined by George Eaton, our political editor, and Anoush Kalian, the acting editor of the Staggers, who've just returned from Birmingham, where the Tories held their conference. George, you've written in your column this week that David Cameron was quite chipper. In fact, the whole Tory party conference were quite chipper. When they're 4 points behind in the polls, why are they so happy?
They were happy partly because of how badly Labour went. That confirmed their belief that they're in better shape than the opposition, that they deserve to win the election, and that they can win the election. Of course, the consideration they then come to is this isn't just a straight fight with Labour, that as Cameron himself conceded, he's fighting a war on two fronts, the second being against UKIP. But given the circumstances in which the conference started, with the reckless defection and the resignation of Brooks Newmark, it was remarkably successful. And Cameron, whose speech went very well yesterday, I thought it was probably the best he'd given as Conservative leader, benefited from actually holding quite a lot of policy back. So his previous two conference addresses were very light on policy. And yesterday he had huge amounts of policy to put out there. And it's quite significant that he felt the need to make such a big move on tax and on other issues to try and check Labour's advantage.
So the two big moves on tax are raising the personal allowance, which has already gone up to 10,000. It would be hopefully to make that go up to 12,500, yeah. Which, Anoush, you were saying that the Lib Dems are a bit miffed about because they had to lobby quite hard for it to be raised to 10,000. And Now the Tories have kind of owned that and bigfooted it by making it look like this is their thing. And the second thing is to reduce this thing we have called fiscal drag, where more and more people are getting sucked into the top tax bands. So as I understand it, the rate that you will start paying 40p tax on is going to go up quite significantly by about £9,000.
250,000, yes.
Yeah, although that will happen, be eroded by inflation, and in some ways it's playing a game of catch-up anyway. But you were saying, so this is a kind of, they've been stealing Lib Dem policies to placate UKIP. That's the state of politics today.
Yeah, it's a sign of how weird the political landscape is now, because, as you said, taking people out of the personal tax allowance is a Lib Dem policy, and it's something that they will be championing at their conference. But Labour but the Tories have stolen that from them. And also, one of UKIP's ideas during their conference was to scrap income tax on minimum wage, which is basically what Cameron was doing with this tax cut. So yes, he's using a UKIP idea with a Lib Dem policy.
The other thing I thought was really interesting, George, was this idea of the NHS. So Cameron in his speech got very misty-eyed and said, you know, Labour attacked me across the NHS, but my disabled son used the NHS. I was so proud of it. Is this a terrible harbinger of a campaign that is going to be absolutely fixated on the NHS?
Well, it's quite clear that Labour intend to make it one of their key themes, and quite rightly, because it's the issue in which they enjoy the biggest lead. And Cameron famously once described it as his political priority. So he said, Tony Blair said my priorities are education, education, education. I can do it in three letters, NHS. But it's an issue about which the Tories have had a lot less to say recently. In fact, Lyndon Crosby has even told ministers don't speak about it too much because it's a Labour issue and that they benefit. But what I think Cameron was trying to do with that quite powerful intervention in his speech was to neutralise the issue, to say, look, I care about the NHS too, don't attack me. There are some who think that's, you know, admirable and sincere, but there are others who I think almost regard it as a form of emotional blackmail and actually... And also doubt that Cameron's defence of his commitment to the NHS will wash with voters who are finding it impossible to get a GP appointment or have had to wait for weeks for an operation.
They're going to be wheeling out those posters as well about I pledge no more top-down reorganisations of the NHS, which obviously then no government can resist, it seems, a top-down reorganisation of the NHS. So moving into the upcoming conference, do you think there'll be a similar mood of optimism among Lib Dems? Because they're in a very strange position too, where they face, you know, they're at single figures in the polls, but it's entirely possible that they could once again hold the balance of power. So are they going to be similarly... I mean, they have been extremely chipper throughout the whole parliament.
I mean, that's what's really surprising, how united the Lib Dems have remained, with the exception of the brief but actually sort of pathetic coup attempts against Clegg. You haven't had any defections, for instance, from the Lib Dems. And you're right to say that is their big hope, that they may go down to as few as 30 MPs from their current level of 56, but they'll still hold the balance of power. They can still get back into government. And there's some in the party who obviously look forward to the prospect of potentially governing with Labour because they could get more of their policies introduced and would also establish them as the natural coalition partner. We can govern with the left as well as the right. There are also some, of course, who dread the possibility of governing with Labour for various reasons. I mean, partly because they are to the right of Labour on some issues now, but also because they looked at the Blair and Brown years in the briefing and actually imagined that governing with Labour would be quite nasty.
Yes, I can imagine that. Yeah, it wouldn't be all sweetness and light in the Lib Lab coalition. And to move on to UKIP, they had an extraordinary conference, Anoush, at Doncaster Racecourse, where they did some very interesting things, I thought, where they sort of floated very left-wing policies, the so-called this idea of the WAG tax, where you'd get taxed a higher rate of VAT on luxury cars and handbags and shoes and things like that, quickly squashed by Nigel Farage. Now, they're in the happy position that the Lib Dems wants in, where they can kind of throw together a slightly mishmashed... But do you think they will move now to trying to get more populist and more left-wing policies rather than selling themselves explicitly as a libertarian-style party?
I think that would be a good move to them because I think the people who they are wooing on the right, they've pretty much won them now. So it's quite a good idea to fight this other front to get these Labour voters in. And actually, I think... Tim Wigmore, one of our reporters who was at the conference, he was reporting from the fringe that there are people saying they want to renationalise the railways and that kind of thing.
Well, as George will tell you, 66%, isn't it, of the British public want to do the same.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a left and right wing thing. It's just things that are popular with the public.
And they've been in a slightly luxurious position, as the Lib Dems once were, of never having to worry about how you actually turn that into a programme for government. So the other big thing that's coming up in the next couple of weeks are two big by-elections. So we have a by-election in Clacton caused by the defection of Douglas Carswell from the Tories to UKIP. George, he's expected to hang on there, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So there were a lot of polls which came out almost just days after his defection, showing him, 40 points ahead. He's got a very strong reputation in the seats. It was a seat that UKIP were in a strong position to win. Anyway, so the Conservatives have effectively conceded that in advance to him. And there are also some who are always reluctant to campaign against him because Carswell is a figure who is well-liked and well-respected. Mark Reckless is quite a different case, though.
So this is the other by-election, which is in Rochester and Strood in Kent. and it's looking less hopeful for him.
It is, and actually the Tories now regard it as essential to win that by-election, to act as a firebreaker on UKIP, to halt their momentum. So one cabinet minister told me, you know, we have to cut them off at the legs. It's an opportunity to turn a crisis to our benefits and to signal to other would-be defectors, you're not guaranteed to win if you stand under UKIP colours.
Which is an interesting point, because there were all kinds of whispers throughout Tory conference of another big defector being, in fact, someone was going to spoil Cameron's speech. And in the end, it happened that there was a donor who defected and then gave even more money when it turned out that, because he was piqued that William Hague didn't know who he was. Plus one of Boris's old deputy mayors who'd previously been expelled from the Conservative Party moved over to UKIP. But there wasn't another Douglas Carswell level shock, was there?
Yes, exactly. And so everyone, those reporters who went to Bristol yesterday, straight from Birmingham for the surprise UKIP press conference, were quite disappointed when it turned out that the big announcement was that a donor was giving them £1 million rather than £100,000. And the speculation now is obviously, was there a third defector lined up who got cold feet? Perhaps they were won over by Cameron's conference speech. Perhaps they've seen the Tory party declare total war on Mark Reckless, trash his reputation all week, and thought, you know what, I'm not actually sure I want to be taken out in that way.
There is a big calculation to be made if you are a Tory and you feel much more optimistic about being in government this time next year, that there is still the tiniest glimmer of you having some influence or maybe getting a junior role. Whereas if you go to UKIP, obviously you would be a big fish in a small pond, but you're unlikely to hold a ministerial position. I think that's not really something we can all foresee. Well, we'll reconvene once we've survived Lib Dem conference, but for the moment, it's a thank you to Georgia and Anoush. Yesterday, copyright laws changed, which means that we can now do more parodies. I'm joined by Ian Steadman, who, for some reason, I don't know why this is your thing. I guess it's tech, isn't
it's
it?
Tech. It's tech, right?
To talk about... first of all, tell me exactly what's changed.
Okay. Well, obviously, copyright is all about stopping people doing stuff with things that you create without your permission. But copyright law usually has exceptions for that, for stuff like... parody, for instance, or quoting someone, like you're writing a newspaper article, you should be able to quote someone and not get sued for it. And that's all kind of common sense, but often the law lags behind on how people actually use stuff. And this is one of the few things that I'll give credit to the coalition government for, but when they came in 2010, they commissioned a review of intellectual property laws because it was out of date and stuff. People do things like, until yesterday, it was illegal to rip a CD from a CD, music from a CD to your computer and then put it on an MP3 player. Technically, it was illegal. Like, that wasn't allowed as an exception in copyright
law. So now that
law.
That's legal, I can say that I spent a large part of the 90s.
You are now allowed to record music onto a cassette for listening in the car if you want to.
Thank God that's
yes.
coming.
It's
Minidisc?
Minidisc, yeah. DVD, CD, HD DVD, if you can still find one of those around. But there's a whole raft of things that they found from this review that were totally out of date. One of which was that it was technically not allowed to do stuff like take a clip from a TV show or a movie and use it as part of a larger critique or parody. Or, like, say, you're now allowed to do a parody song, like Weird Al Yankovic style, where you sing essentially the same song with different lyrics to take the piss out of someone. That's now legal under British copyright
law. So it's one of those
law.
Things where presumably they weren't hauling people up in front of the beat
no.
going, your version of...
The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber, who offer their drivers worker protections and a range of benefits, including access to fully funded undergraduate degree courses through the Open University.
It's like a dream that was something that was missing from myself.
Sanan Ahmed has been driving with Uber for 8 years.
I start driving with Uber because it provides flexibility. You can work whenever you want. I couldn't complete my studies before. I had a huge gap of almost 5 years. When I get into IT, I was working full-time with Uber, and they gave the opportunity, like, you can study while you work. With the Open University, it was the same thing. It's flexible. You can take your lectures whenever you're free. I've studied the bachelor's in business management, graduated last year. Currently, I'm doing my master's. That impact that Uber and Open University had on my future, I'm very positive. Now I've got goals that I've set for myself, and before there was no way I could achieve it. But now I feel like I'm in the right direction.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
You know, Lady Gaga's telephone where you've made it about British telecom. That would be a this is why I don't write parody
scathing
songs.
Satire that, yeah.
It's technically legal, but now it is explicitly fine.
Yeah, there's this new concept. In America, they have this idea of fair use, and what's been brought in here is called fair dealing, which is that a exception to copyright for parody and pastiche is okay as long as it's something that a reasonable and honest person would be expected to do in the same situation, which is one of those legal definitions that you often get where it's like defining pornography under the law. It's like no one actually does it, but they know it when they see it. So that's now okay. You can now mock people mercilessly. There's that popular rap of the cassette boy rap David Cameron thing that's going around the internet at the moment.
So technically Nick Clegg could have sued the people who auto-tuned his I'm so sorry.
I don't know if he held copyright on that.
I suppose it wasn't. I guess the news channel probably owned it, but it was.
But again, it's like one of the things where in practice he wouldn't do that because a politician sat suing someone for that.
The worst idea
destroy your career. And also it's just, it wasn't in the interest of anyone to really pursue individual people violating the law in that way. But there are also lots of other things that have been brought in. This is the second half. There was a first half that's brought in on the 1st of June. And the stuff that's been brought in is really useful. Like now it's okay if there's a version of a film or TV show that doesn't have subtitles. You can't legally buy it with subtitles. People who need subtitles to watch stuff are now allowed to create subtitles for films. Which and publish them online.
A huge point for accessibility. I guess the same thing with those hearing described versions of soundtracks and stuff like that. You would probably, I don't think they were hauling deaf people up in court, but it's good to have that officially recognised.
It's essentially, these are just reforms to reflect the way that people actually use music. But of course, the hilarious thing with things like mini discs is it's so out of date when it comes to ripping CDs and stuff.
Yes, you can now put it on your phonogram.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit late now. But
the one that they haven't done, which I think is really tricky, is they still haven't overturned the ban in using parliamentary footage in a satirical context. So this is something I wrote about in 2011. People constantly say, the Daily Show in America is really great, or now John Oliver's new show, which does a lot of the same techniques. And they say, they show huge amounts of C-SPAN on that. If you ever watch the US version, they just sit and play a Senate committee hearing and then talk through it.
Yep.
And there was this ridiculous situation a couple of years ago where they, even the shortened roundup version that they show, the global edition on that they show on More 4 or whatever it is, they wouldn't show because John Stewart was talking about David Cameron at Prime Minister's Questions responding to the hacking situation. He was actually being really complimentary about him. He was saying that, in America, they would never have just people just shouting, you just answer the question, and sort of all the things that Dennis Skinner says to people in the chamber. And Cameron dealt with it, with real aplomb. They would never let their president do that, or even their Senate majority leader. But they couldn't show that because the whole programme is deemed to be satirical. And it was something that really hobbled 10 o'clock live.
They
couldn't do any coverage
so.
Of politics. I mean, it's less of an issue now that so much of politics happens outside the chamber, but it's still a real anomaly that actually, I don't think anyone could make the argument that you don't learn a huge amount from something like The Daily Show. I was incredibly well informed about American politics when I used to watch it regularly. Yeah.
There was a study recently which found that it assessed Americans watching the news, basically. They asked them what shows they watched and they tested them on current affairs to see how informed they were. And Daily Show viewers were the most informed.
Well, it's the thing. Yeah. I was quite well up on sort of minor random politicians in that they had a guy in the Republican Party who had the most ridiculous name. Oh, I've even forgotten it. It was so ludicrous. Reince Priebus. And they were obsessed with this guy called Reince Priebus. It is a really crazy name. But yeah, we could do something similar here if only
Absolutely.
You were allowed to.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the next waves of copyright activism. Basically, all the copyright activists who are delighted with these changes still pointing out that just really obvious bar to satire is still there.
Yeah, and it's not really like that's the thing that's preserving the dignity of our politicians, tragically.
No, they do a pretty bad job of doing that.
And on that note, I'll say thank you very much, Ian.
My name's Philip Morn, and I'm joined by Caroline Crampton to talk about John Taverner, the composer who died at the end of last year, and has his final work is being performed at the Barbican at the minute. So the work is called Flood of Beauty, and what is it?
Well, predictably for John Taverner, if you know any of his work, he was relatively popular. He was very interested in other world religions than Christianity. He himself was converted to Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Christianity in the 70s. But since then, he wrote music that encompassed all different faiths. And this one is particularly focused on Hinduism. And it's a setting of a very, very long Sanskrit poem about a goddess called Devi, who is the kind of female heart of the universe, I suppose, the kind of eternal feminine. So it's this very, very long poem. And he wrote this music, I think, in 2007, but it had never been performed, and then he died last year, and so the Barbican have now mounted it as a kind of tribute to him. And it's a vast work. It's sort of an hour and 40 minutes, I think, straight through. It requires all kinds of musicians and singers, a whole orchestra, some Indian musicians, several choirs, a string quartet, a brass ensemble, all these different things. And it creates this kind of immersive wash of sound that you're supposed to sit in the centre of, thus to mimic the subject of the poem.
How does it compare to the rest of his work? I mean, it's the more choral end of stuff that I'm familiar with, and I think that probably a lot of people recognise. But, I mean, so, is it something totally new? Or
It's not that new, although you're quite right. His most popular works are, I think, two pieces. One, Song for Athene, which was a choral thing that was sung at Princess Diana's funeral. Mm. And the other is his setting of William Blake's poem, The Lamb, yeah, which is played on the radio an awful lot, especially Classic FM. Which are, I think, what makes them so popular and so enduring is their simplicity, because they're simple words, simple musical lines brought together in a very kind of open harmony. This is not like that. If you've dug a bit deeper into his repertoire and you've come across things like The Veil of the Temple from 2003, I think this is, obviously it's both choral and instrumental. It's quite noisy and chaotic. There's lots of things happening at the same time. Even this piece is written in five cycles, which I think, although I'm no expert on Sanskrit poetry, reflects the cycles of the poem. And at the end of each cycle, this great big kind of crashing cacophony comes down to a single cello solo. Really, really beautiful line. But while the cellist is playing, someone's kind of bonging gongs in the background. So you're never entirely left with that purity of line that we know from his more popular pieces.
Can you, for those who don't know Taverner all that well, can you say something a little bit about his life? Because I remember reading the obituaries last year when he died. You wrote a piece, I remember, about seeing The Veil of the Temple in this sort of, wasn't it, overnight kind of performance.
Yeah.
It seems to be, well, two things. One is that his own life and his battle with ill health is quite striking. It's amazing he was able to be as productive as he was. But also that some of the staging of performances of his sound quite radical and quite interesting as well.
Yeah, so you're quite right. The name of the disease completely eludes me, but it's quite rare. He was diagnosed with this condition, I think it's an immunocondition, relatively young, and he was not expected to live as long as he did, nor live as full a life as he did. And he had a stroke very young, and then I think later on into middle age, he had a very serious heart attack that took him several years to recover from. So he was, I think his widow gave an interview last week in The Telegraph, I think, where she kind of said that death was never far from his mind in every aspect, both personally and sort of musically. He was always very aware of the kind of precariousness of being. But on your second point about the staging of his pieces, it's clearly something that he cared very much about. The Veil of the Temple, which you allude to, I think it takes 7 hours to perform. And it's this kind of hybrid oratorio and vigil. Vigil from the Russian Orthodox tradition of sort of vespers and meditative music. And then oratorio from the more sort of classical Western tradition of telling an epic story through song. Think of Handel's Messiah or something like that. And the story that he chose to tell there was the story of the Knights Templar and the story of the temple in Jerusalem. And the premiere of this was held in 2003 at the Temple Church in London, the burial resting place of the Knights Templar. And it was held sort of over all night, over the night, and it was intended, and indeed it was in fact the case, that the kind of final cycle should coincide with the dawn, with the light kind of coming through the church windows to maximise the effect of the music that he'd written.
Something that I know Rowan Williams often talks about, a figure really interested in the Eastern Church, is its kind of meditative elements. You know, they talk about the Jesus Prayer used in, you know, which is a simple repetition which takes you to some kind of transcendent state. Would you say that a lot of his music is aiming at some kind of transcendence for the listener?
Yes, absolutely. And you hear that a lot in this Flood of Beauty, this work that's just been performed now. There's a lot of... Because the way the Barbican of Dulux, obviously, it's in a language that pretty much nobody speaks. So they project a translation on the wall as it's in quite a nice, unobtrusive way, in the sense that it's not like opera subtitles or surtitles. If you don't want to read it, if you just want to listen to the music, it doesn't intrude on your eyeline. But if you are interested in what they're singing about, you can read it. I mean, and I will say some of it is quite kind of fruity. There's a lot about how the goddess's breasts are like elephant ears, and praising the crescents of her toenails and this kind of stuff. But there is also an awful lot of repetition of the same kind of words and the same kind of phrases. And that's mirrored in the vocal lines that he wrote for those words. The idea being that you're kind of comforted and lulled by this repetition into a point where your mind rises above into something else.
And who wouldn't want that? Thanks very much, Carolyn.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Morn.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.